Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President-elect Donald Trump's feud with civil rights icon Congressman John Lewis is making headlines. First, Lewis called Trump an illegitimate president. Then Trump took to Twitter saying Lewis is all talk. And the tension raises the profile of an already simmering problem of race relations in this country. Sociologist and minister Michael Eric Dyson has a message for white America. Stop it. Think about black suffering. Own up and do something about it. This hour on Point, Tears We Cannot Stop, Michael Eric Dyson's sermon to white America. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the tension between the president-elect and Congressman Lewis? How do you see race relations in America now? Do you see signs of hope or danger as the new president takes the oath of office? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Indianapolis, Indiana, is Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at Georgetown University and ordained minister. He's author of 19 books. His newest is Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. And you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Eric Dyson, it's wonderful to have you. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So this book is really a culmination of some very personal stories about what it means to be black in America. What was that process like for you to revisit some of those stories from your past?
Well, it was quite intriguing and at points quite painful to relive some of the grief, some of the agony, some of the hostility, the resentment, the competing emotions that claimed a space in my spirit and upon reflection in my mind, trying to, if you will, figure out the right balance between the expression of a raw emotion and, upon reflection, the attempt to fit it into a larger landscape of reflection on what it means to be black and what it means to be subject to police brutality, and sometimes to the rampant hostility of a broader world, and sometimes just the ignorance and the insensitivity that one confronts as well. So all of those things were claiming space as I tried to write about this. And this book is a much more personal book than any other book that I've written. So I had to dig deeper into the well of my own personal and existential thoughts about things. And it got a bit uncomfortable at times.
Right. You say, in fact, you write, "What I need to say to white America can only be said in a plea, a cry, a sermon from my heart to yours." You're a distinguished professor, a writer, a sociologist. You're also a Baptist minister, ordained Baptist minister. Which part of white America or what part of white America do you envision reading this book?
Well, I hope as many white brothers and sisters as possible. Obviously, I think that those who are empathetic to black people and sympathetic to our perspectives, our struggles, our trials and traumas, those white Americans who embrace Barack Obama as the last best hope of a particular era to talk about issues of American identity and citizenship and democracy and equality and freedom and justice, those white brothers and sisters for sure. Some who may be on the fence, I'm inclined to think about these issues, but not necessarily convinced. I certainly want to reach out to them as well. But this is presented as a kind of sermonic plea and a challenge to the soul of America, white America in particular, to say, look, we got to get beyond some of this willful innocence, this refusal to engage the broader landscape of American race, the willful denial of the traumas and truths and tragedies that black people face on the regular and routinely, and figure out if we can't at least be honest about it. It's always interesting to me when I hear President-elect Donald Trump speak about getting beyond political correctness, and I hear many white brothers and sisters say, hey, let's tell the truth. Let's be politically incorrect. Except, of course, when it comes to telling the truth about white America and what that means. Even that term arouses some white brothers and sisters, ruffles the feathers, because to be considered collectively is something that's antithetical or counterintuitive to many white brothers and sisters. So I'm trying to tread that territory in this book.
So a lot to get to this hour in terms of the outgoing president to the incoming one. But I need to start with what's happening right now. The civil rights icon, John Lewis, embroiled in a battle with Donald Trump. Here he is in an interview with NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. Georgia Congressman John Lewis saying he would not attend the presidential inauguration this Friday. He cited concerns about Russian involvement in the U.S. election. Donald Trump responded with angry tweets. Here is the remark from Lewis that launched the Trump attacks.
I believe in forgiveness. I believe in trying to work with people. It's going to be hard. It's going to be very difficult. I don't see this president-elect as a legitimate president.
Michael Eric Dyson, a lot of reporting about how this back and forth underscores Trump's tense relationship with black voters, with black Americans. What kind of impact does it have for John Lewis to call President-elect Trump an illegitimate president?
Well, you know, they used to say turnabout is fair play. Isn't it interesting that Donald Trump, a man who spent the entire part of his initial ascent as a political figure of some worth and estimable value in America, contesting the legitimacy of Barack Obama. I mean, this is incredible that people don't understand. If you do it, that is, challenge the legitimacy of a sitting president. Donald Trump has not yet taken office, although he is duly sworn in and seated as our chief executive, as our commander in chief. But the reality is Barack Obama was in office, sworn in, elected, doing his job, and Donald Trump ate at him, picked at him, assaulted him, insulted him relentlessly with little predicate. The birth certificate issue that drove the racist birthers was largely deconstructed, and yet Donald Trump, in the face of an avalanche of counterproof and counterfactual evidence, persisted in his bigoted beliefs. And now his thin skin is intolerant of a challenge to his legitimacy by one of the most iconic figures in American politics and one of the great heroes in our society. So I think it's extremely important, as Paul Krugman, I think, said in the New York Times yesterday, it was extremely important that Congressman Lewis raised this issue of Donald Trump's legitimacy, because it has to press us to think about the issues of politics and culture and race in our own time.
Let me step back a bit and hear from President Obama himself on these issues. Here he is in his farewell address last Tuesday in Chicago, President Obama speaking about race relations in this country.
After my election, there was talk of a post-racial America. And such a vision, however well-intended, was never realistic. Race remains a potent and often divisive force in our society. Now, I've lived long enough to know that race relations are better than they were 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, no matter what some folks say.
Race relations are better than they were 10, 20 years ago, no matter what some folks say. Your response to that, Michael Eric Dyson?
Well, it's a glass half empty, glass half full. Of course, a president, a sitting president, an exiting president who has witnessed under his a particular administration some of the most withering assaults upon racial democracy in the last half century, would put a more positive spin on it, and understandably so. And Barack Obama's election itself betokened and gestured toward a new day for race in America. So that's understandable. But on the other hand, under this president, the renaissance, the recrudescence, the resurgence of bitter racism, naked vitriol toward people of color, anti-black racism in powerful forms. When we think about police brutality's resurgence and the unapologetic character with which many police carried out their work against the vulnerable bodies of black and brown people. When we think about the fact that there was an assault upon Obama himself by police departments who were cracking racist jokes. when you think about the rates at which black people are expelled from school much earlier at a much higher rate than their white counterparts. Time and again, we look at the housing situation for black people and the unemployment rate. So across the board, things are pretty tough for black people. Malcolm X says, you can't stick a knife in my back 9 inches, pull it out 6 inches and call that progress. It's still pretty bad and it's still pretty rough. And I think we have to be honest about that to acknowledge, yes, there's been extraordinary progress on one hand, but there's been the persistence of a lethal and malevolent form of racial animus on the other hand.
The New York Times had a terrific piece on Obama and race this weekend, which suggested that early on in his presidency, Obama was reticent to talk about race, that he referred to it only really in general terms. And it was a series of tragic events that led to the deaths of young black men that got the president sort of energized about talking about this issue. And that the speech in Chicago last week seemed to be a very direct conversation about race that many had been looking for all along. Are you disappointed in any way that the president didn't speak more explicitly or aggressively about race and racism, especially early on in his presidency?
Well, a year before that New York Times piece posted, I made those arguments in far more extensive fashion in my book about Barack Obama called The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America, which is literally just out in paperback. So I've made those arguments at far more length and depth about what Barack Obama confronted, what he was able to say, what he didn't say, what he felt he was allowed and permitted to tackle, and things that he avoided. He did practice what I term in my book racial procrastination, and he was forced into doing things. His hand was often forced. Now, on the one hand, we understand this. The first black president doesn't want to make his major theme and his leitmotif to be race in America. He doesn't want to ghettoize himself. On the other hand, he could ill afford to avoid the perilous path that race would take under his administration. So he was in a tough situation, to be sure. And I think he often made the wrong choice to avoid race and to avoid some of the racial consternation that was occasioned by some of the crises that came up under his administration.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour with sociologist and ordained minister Michael Eric Dyson about race relations in America today. And you can join the conversation. What do you see ahead from a Trump administration on race relations? Are you marching? Would you boycott the inauguration? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. During his farewell address last Tuesday in Chicago, President Obama spoke about what white Americans need to do to improve race relations in this country moving forward.
For white Americans, it means acknowledging that the effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't suddenly vanish in the 60s. That when minority groups voice discontent, they're not just engaging in reverse racism or practicing political correctness. When they wage peaceful protests, they're not demanding special treatment, but the equal treatment that our founders promised.
And here is President Obama again in the same speech saying that race remains an often divisive force in our country.
If every economic issue is framed as a struggle between a hardworking white middle class and an undeserving minority, then workers of all shades are going to be left fighting for scraps while the wealthy withdraw further into their private enclaves.
So Michael Eric Dyson, President Obama, talking about race relations in the context of coming together, right? He spoke about the need to understand not just the reality of black and brown lives, but also the lives of middle-aged white men. I'm curious, given that context of the president, could it be that our divisions are not so much racial, but that they are about underlying economic issues, a changing economy, a lack of opportunity that so many people feel?
Welcome to the world of black people every day. A changing economy, a lack of opportunity. That is indeed what African-American people and Latino people have been saying Look at the last election when people said, well, this is the revenge, so to speak, of the white working class. The white working class. There are black and brown working classes that were ignored. They didn't vote for Trump disproportionately. There are rural black and brown people. They did not vote for Trump. So how can we ignore the evident and manifest difference that whiteness made? And I think, unfortunately, for many working class white brothers and sisters and many poor ones, what they have been often offered is what Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, the great scholar, called the psychic wages of whiteness. They have been mollified. They have been, in one sense, marginalized because rich white and wealthy white people said to them, at least you're not black, at least you're not brown. So you have the advantage of not being the detestable and horrendous Negro over there, to make them accept their own plight and predicament, which was extremely poor. Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail in Birmingham. And the white jailers came to him and said, you're wrong about protests and we're right about segregation and you're wrong. And he asked them, how much money do you make? And when he found out that they made so little, he said, you need to be out there marching with us. You're in the same boat. But racism prevents many working class white people from joining with black and brown people and red and yellow people, for that matter, to together form a coalition of desperate alliance against the forces of economic devastation and inequality that prevent us from flourishing. So racism has been sold as a bill of goods to satiate the consciences and the desires of working class white people while giving them the okey-doke and keeping us all divided. So when we say underlying, it's an economic issue, no, because black poverty is more concentrated than white poverty. Latino poverty even more so than white poverty. So there are ways in which race makes class hurt more, and class makes race hurt and impactful more.
Here is President-elect Donald Trump on the campaign trail in September in North Carolina, promising to raise up African-American communities, asking, what do voters have to lose because Trump will fix these communities?
Our African-American communities are absolutely in the worst shape that they've ever been in before, ever, ever, ever. You take a look at the inner cities, you get no education, you get no jobs, you get shot walking down the street. They're worse. I mean, honestly, places like Afghanistan are safer than some of our inner cities.
Michael Eric Dyson, how was that message received within the black community, would you say?
Well, here's the problem. Now, on the surface, let's give Donald Trump some credit. There was a lot of tension and trauma and suffering in black America. We don't have to simply turn to Chicago or Philadelphia, New York, Detroit, Los Angeles. We know that's real. So on the one hand, what he's saying is apparent and powerful. But the problem is the context. You know, here's a man who spent so much of his time assaulting the most prominent black person on the globe, undermining his capacity to address many of the issues about which Donald Trump was remonstrating. So people, it's not that people denied the legitimacy of what Donald Trump may have reflected on. It is the fact that the context within which he says it shows that he is disingenuous about truly addressing those issues. And furthermore, when Donald Trump is speaking about the plight and predicament of black America, what is he doing to help that by ginning up a kind of racial bravado against vulnerable black people at his rallies? Back in our, you know, back in the day, we would just take them out. Look at the racial wolf whistling going on. Look at the racial coding that's going on in the rhetoric of President-elect Trump. So here's a man who, on the one hand, acknowledges some issues that presidents don't usually acknowledge. Poverty and the persistence of inequality. Even the present, sitting president, didn't necessarily address that in a powerful fashion. Hence, the appeal of a person like Bernie Sanders. And yet, on the other hand, Bernie Sanders himself may not have been as sensitive to issues of racial inequality that overlay economic inequality that make things even worse.
Our lines are lighting up. Let's get some listeners in here. Michael Eric Dyson. Let's go first to Jeff in Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and I love your show. It's the best on the radio. I'm a news junkie.
Thank you.
I agree with your guest. The problem with race relations, it's getting worse, and I think it will continue to get worse. And part of the problem is, as I see it, is that there's a lot of facts and truths that are omitted. You know, I was, Trump's tweet was true. I don't like Trump. I didn't vote for him. I think he's a nut. But his response is true. This weekend, I was in Atlanta. I was doing the Scott's Antique Market. I deal art and antiques. It's in the heart of John Lewis's district. Okay, at 6 a.m. on Saturday morning, I went across the street to the gas station to get a cup of coffee. And five young black men approached me with hands full of crack cocaine, saying, "You want to buy some? I got you. You want to buy some?" And I said, "No, thank you." You know, but and I listened to CNN. I read the New York Times, Washington Post. And no one's talking about the truth. And that's why Trump was elected, you know, and people are tired of this omission of the truth. And we have to have full open discourse from all sides.
Jeff, thank you. Michael Eric Dyson, you talk about in your book this concept that the election of Donald Trump more than anything else signifies an underlying fear, the underlying force of the fear unleashed by the Obama presidency. I mean, to Jeff's point, how is the election of Donald Trump a direct result of Barack Obama's presidency?
Well, I think that there's unconscious bias and there's conscious resistance to Obama as a black figure whose tongue, both literally and symbolically, you know, had a huge impact upon American ideals. Obama was the voice piece for America for the last 8 years. When we looked at the face of America, we saw this brown face of Barack Obama. When we looked at the temperature that this society was cooking up, so to speak, at which it was boiling, it was measured in response often to the presidential presence and the policies of Barack Obama. There was resistance and animus. From the day one, many white Republicans and politicians said, "We're trying to make him an unsuccessful president, not work with him where we can to make this a better nation, but to tooth and nail oppose him." So when you consider all this stuff, it's very difficult to get beyond the issue of race. But let me address the caller's point here, because, see, this is, again, I think, part of the problem. And bless him for telling the truth as he sees it, like these guys with crack cocaine. We got a million stories of white brothers and sisters doing the opposite. We got white folk who are involved in drugs, except they don't get demonized. They get medicalized. Oh, my God, our children are now subject to heroin. Our children are now subject to meth. And instead of criminalizing them, what do? We medicalize it, which we should do. But we want some of that for African-American and Latino people, too. Notice the caller didn't say what we need now is an intervention in a medical force to relieve the suffering and agony of those people who turn to crack cocaine because of lack of economic opportunity, because of lack of social justice. No, it's a demonization of them for their personal behavior. And yet those white brothers and sisters who abuse daily heroin, cocaine and meth are seen as subject to addictive behaviors that need to be medically relieved as opposed to criminalized. That's the kind of imbalance that we have. And until we get to that heart of the matter, that's the political incorrectness we refuse to deal with and to grapple with in our society.
You don't pull any punches in this book. You write things like whiteness grows more shameless, more cruel, more uncaring by the day. It's hard to be white and empathetic to others. You also write, so much has been invested in whiteness that it's hard to let it go. It is often defensive, resentful, full of denial and amnesia. Repent of your whiteness. As I was reading this book, I wondered, is that the tone that creates the kind of dialogue that we need right now in this country?
Well, two things. Excellent critique. I wanted to, in a sermon, you know, they're not there to say, you know, the Lord bless you and your sin is going to go away if you sin. Now, come on. I'm a preacher. Preachers dramatize. They're theatrical. They state and overstate. I don't think I'm necessarily overstating the case here. I'm trying to, with flourish and elegance and eloquence, hopefully, bringing to bear the rhetorical arsenal that has been deployed by, you know, my people from time immemorial in regard to, you know, the black pulpit, to tell America that we are in trouble. I've got to announce the bad news before the good news gets here. I've got to tell the truth about what America is before we can get to what America ought to be. And yes, yes, we can't have conversation over niceties that are spewed and people refusing to tell the truth. Sometimes we got to hear the raw, unvarnished truth from a black agent, a black figure, a black articulate person that makes us angry, that makes us reflective, that initially pushes us back but then invites us in, rather than another approach. Think about it. President Obama is as nice and as genial a figure as possible, and yet under his administration, the most horrible, rancid forms of racism were resurgent. So that didn't work either. So I think it's necessary for us to tell as much of the truth as we can in the ways we can find available.
Isn't it likely that many white people, even sympathetic readers, might look at those comments at a book like this as sort of a catalog of white sins? I mean, I'm trying to get to what you want people to feel when they read this. Is it agitation? Is it anger? Move to action? What is it?
Yes. So the thing is, in that catalog of sins, and I'm thankful for Professor Phillips, the reviewer in the New York Times, who said to white people, look, you may see this as a catalog of sins, but it's so much more. And it is so much more, because I'm dealing with the depth of compassion and the depth of hurt and agony. But one of the privileges of whiteness is not to hear the other. One of the privileges of whiteness is to be vulnerable and fragile. Oh, my God, don't insult me. Don't make me think too hard about the issues that I want to avoid. No, mommy, no. No, I don't want to deal with that right now. And whiteness itself, as an investment in innocence, has hurt other white brothers and sisters, too, not just African-American people. The inability to grow up, to grow into the full weight and measure and depth of your humanity. That's the challenge before us. And I think that many white brothers and sisters who hear me and who know what I'm saying and who read what I say will see beyond the explicit and honest expression, the depth of love I have, the profound appreciation for the struggle toward transformation I have. That's why in the book, by the way, I challenge black people about our homophobia, about our love of light versus dark skin. I talk about our enthralled and enchanted engagement with the things that white supremacy have made available to us and the payoffs for that. So that chapter is right there in the book trying to challenge us as well. So I'm a balanced interpreter of that racial landscape that we now occupy.
Michael, Eric Dyson, I've got to get some listeners in here. Let's get KK from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air. Welcome. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I'm actually a huge fan of Michael Eric Dyson. You are my hero. And I want to say that the problem we have in this country is that we never address race. Whenever you bring it up, it's like throwing a grenade into a conversation. We need to address it. I have a German friend who blurted out one day, oh, my uncle was a Nazi. I was taken aback. But you know what? He said, we talk about it. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. He was. They discuss it. In America, you can never talk about race.
Thank you so very kindly. I want to, first of all, thank you for your beautiful support and comments and encouragement to me. But I think she's absolutely right. It is time that we confront it head on. We've got to be honest about it. It's there. Let's not pretend it's not there. You know, Gore Vidal, the late great writer, said, we live in the United States of amnesia. And in my book, as you know, Jane, I talk about the five stages of white, you know, of white grief when whiteness has to confront something it doesn't like. And one of them, of course, is dealing with this issue of denial and the pretension that things are not real. And so we got to get out of the fantasy land, the Disneyland approach to race, and deal with the reality that is before us. And when we do so, the payoffs are so much richer, so much more real, so much more rewarding, because now when we confront this issue, we can move past the impasse to which we have been subject.
So do you think that President Obama's years in office have contributed to heighten racial tensions, or are we just more aware of it now?
Well, both. I mean, it was heightened under him because as a black figure, he brought a lot of consternation and a lot of discomfort to many white people who didn't want to see a black man in charge. Now, we can dress it up and gussy it up and make it sound all highfalutin with ideological peregrinations and the like. But the bottom line is, for a lot of white folk, a Negro in charge was a problem. a bête noire. So the reality is that Obama evoked some of this, by being present, not to his chagrin, and that it wasn't his fault, but the reality is for those who were already committed to the principles and practices and presuppositions of bigotry, he exposed it. And even those who thought that they were committed to a certain kind of racial progress may have discovered that the way is much more difficult than once believed. So it was emerging under him. It concretized under him, and unfortunately, it flourished as well.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're speaking this hour with Michael Eric Dyson about his latest book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America, and you can join the conversation. Is Michael Eric Dyson inspiring you to think, to act? Getting a lot of comments on Facebook. Here's one. Dyson is right on about the importance of context. It's not just what Trump is saying about Black America. It's the context in which he addresses it. Bob says the issue is at least as much about class as it is about race. Black people who are doing well are almost as likely to turn a blind eye to what's happening to a growing underclass. Here's another. Unfortunately, I think Obama felt he had to be everybody's president and that to be everyone's president, he couldn't speak frankly about race and racism, which is nonsense. Obama's reticence to speak directly about race and racism is a symptom of our country's inability to talk about it, specifically white Americans' inability to speak about it. Let's go to a call here. Andy in Clearwater, Florida. Andy, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Thank you for having me. My comment is more of how to solve this racism issue. I'm a father of three, and I recently found myself having more and more talks with my kids. My six-year-old saw pictures of slaves in shackles and asked me what the bad people did. I realized then that she wasn't receiving any kind of education of what had happened nothing about the Native American genocide, nothing about slavery, nothing about the struggles that people have gone through.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the cure is in education. It's an early age education. It should be taught to our kids at a very early age to make them, I don't want to say humanize them, but to make them a little bit more empathetic, just like the caller said before.
Mm-hmm. I hear you, Andy.
Bad things happen. Yeah, just because bad things happen, the only way for them not to happen again and for people to understand progress is teaching.
Amen. Andy, thanks so much. Here's Tom in Burlington, Wisconsin. Tom, you're on the air. Welcome.
My father was a member of Congress. His name was Charles A. Boyle, and he passed the first civil rights bill in America after the Civil War. It was the 1957 Civil Rights Act. And Sam Rayburn said, Charlie, you have to put this through the Congress, because if I do, I won't get reelected. And he was assaulted in the cloakroom of the House of Representatives. The congressman said, Charlie, if you keep playing these parliamentary tricks, I'm going to shoot you. The man actually had a knife. But anyway, all the fighting that went through and all the work to get that bill through, the blacks seem to have forgotten that how difficult it is this generation. I have forgotten that for so many years they couldn't vote. And the whites have put obstacles against them in the last 8 years since Obama's elected president. They've got these, in Wisconsin we have an ID thing that you have to have and a driver's license, and they've made it completely complicated.
Thanks for the history. I'm glad that you called, Tom. Let's get one more in here. Jeff in Iowa City, Iowa. Jeff, you're on the air with Michael Eric Dyson. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking the call.
You're welcome.
Big fan. since Trump's been elected, like everyone, I think, I've been trying to answer the question, how did this happen? And this led me to start looking at some voter turnout numbers. And I just want to make a comment that, you know, as was no surprise to me, you know, African-American voters during Obama's administration, specifically the first election, you know, turned out in record numbers, the highest voter turnouts ever for African-Americans or any other race, as far as I could tell from my brief look. And then not only do we see a short, you know, a small drop during his second administration, but now during the Trump administration, I'm seeing numbers that are over 30% lower on African-American turnout.
Jeff,
just
it's
over 70 at its height.
It's an,
just under 40 now.
I'm so glad you called with this. Michael Eric Dyson, I was going to ask you about it as well. Hillary Clinton needed strong support from African-Americans to offset some of Trump's the margin among white voters. She did win 88% of the black vote to 8% of Trump's vote in this election, significantly lower than Obama's 93%. You hear Jeff's numbers. The fact is that African-Americans did not turn out in this election the same way they did 8 years ago. What is their responsibility in activating themselves to get the change that they want to see, especially at the ballot box?
But you're missing the most important number. 54% of white women voted for Trump. Don't ask. 88% of black people is a heck of a performance in light of the fact that white women are voting against their perceived interests for a man who said he could grab their sexual organs as the predicate of his own, if you will, privilege as a celebrity. I mean, that's the astonishing number to me. Black women in aggregate voted more than anybody else for Hillary Clinton. They held, you know, to what, like 94%, something around there. So the reality is the decline in black vote did not win Donald Trump the presidency. It's strategic geographical appeals that he made, four or five states that came out in favor of him that swayed the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton won by almost the popular vote by 3 million, 2.8, 2.9 million. So these numbers are lies, damn lies, and statistics. The reality is that why did so many white women go for a man who is manifestly incapable of acknowledging their existence or speaking to their issues? And I think now there was 13% of black men, which was remarkable, who voted for Donald Trump. But I think that's part of a larger patriarchal blindness to the leadership of women in our country. But in aggregate, when we disaggregate the data, the astonishing thing is that white women did not show up and be accountable for the way in which they have to move beyond a kind of Trump America where vicious isms, bigotry and sexism against women, misogyny against women, patriarchy against women, homophobia, xenophobia against the immigrants. This is what Donald Trump's America heralds, and I think that's what we have to address. Black people did not lose this election. What lost this election was the rebellion against Barack Obama, the rebellion against the perceived dominance of black identities in the face of the decline of white America and the sense of panic that mobilized many white people to vote against their own interests.
Jeff, I'm glad you called. Thank you so much. Michael Eric Dyson, I want to move on to policing because you talk a lot about this in your book. We've seen the shootings, the horrible beatings of black men across this country. Big news from Chicago, from Baltimore, Justice Department investigations, civil rights violations, racially discriminatory behavior aimed at African-Americans and Latinos. Here is U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch during a press conference last week saying that the Chicago Police Department has failed both citizens and officers.
During the course of our investigation, the department heard from countless officers who were themselves disillusioned and discouraged by strained trust, by inadequate training, poor oversight, and inattention to officer wellness and safety. Now, those officers are proud to wear the badge, but they recognize that they lack the support, both from the community and from the city, to properly do their jobs.
You have some very profound and personal examples of police interactions in your book, Michael Eric Dyson. Will you share just one of them with us?
Well, you know, I was with my son and wife in Hartford, Connecticut, as a young professor at Hartford Theological Seminary. And my son was acting out, and I, you know, pulled over to the side and gave him a couple of licks on his hand. I have since grown much more mature and insightful about corporal punishment, but I only literally, spanked him, but hit him on his hands. And then we went on. Everything was fine. I drive up in the front of the seminary where I teach. A police car pulls up and then another and eventually several more. They get me out of the car, push me against the car, don't tell me why I've been stopped. I overhear them talking to my wife about a report, probably, as I say in the book, a well-intending white brother or sister saw me disciplining my child, may have reported it as child abuse. The police showed up. My son is in the back seat crying, saying, "What are you doing to my dad? I'm fine. What's going on?" My wife is saying, "There's nothing going on here." They refuse to tell me what happens. Shove me against the car, finally tell me what's happening. And I tell them I teach here at the seminary. And they say, "Sure." And you know, they disbelieve it. And it was quite, you know, a very vulnerable moment for me and my son and my wife. And I talk about how after that I kind of turned up the volume of F the Police by NWA. And then at another time, you know, I was accosted as a young man, 17 years old. Me and my brother and a friend were driving our father's car. The car had been stolen a couple months before and retrieved, but it hadn't been reported. So they stopped us. No harm there. But then when I reached for my wallet and I announced that I was reaching for my wallet to pull my registration out to prove that we owned the car, the butt of the gun was brought down on my back. I was knocked to the ground. And the policeman called me the N-word and said if I ever did that again, he would shoot me. So, you know, I've had that and so many other experiences with the police who have been a marauding force, an occupying force in many African-American and Latino communities, poor white ones for that matter. But the way in which they have exercised such lethally intense presence against the black bodies of American citizens is one of the great scourges of American democracy and something we have to address.
Here is Sheriff David Clark of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, speaking to Fox News in September, arguing that police brutality is actually not the primary danger facing black communities.
Being on the street in any American ghetto where the black-on-black crime is a bigger threat and a bigger problem in the black community than the police use of force. So the fact that they continue to focus on this aberration, that is the police use of force, it's an aberration, okay? They have more fear of that than, you know, coming across a gang member or being caught in a crossfire.
In fact, the former police chief of Chicago has been quoted as saying that 80% of murder victims in Chicago are black. Less than 1% of all the shootings in Chicago involve police officers shooting civilians. And there's the sheriff of Milwaukee saying black on black crime is a bigger threat than to the black community than the police. You know, police have their own reactions here. Plenty of police attacked. You know, what about the few bad apples argument that we hear so often? I mean, what's the line here? Bottom line, what is the line that's needed to be walked so that everyone is safe, in black and white?
93% of black people who are murdered by black people. 84% of white people who are murdered by white people. Where's the discourse about white-on-white crime? Where's the white moral panic and fear about the decline of the American civilization through the families of white people? Where is the social policy that is directed toward them in a stigmatizing fashion? Where is the pathologization of whiteness? We could go on and on and on because it doesn't serve an ideological position, number one. But let's take that logic, Jane, as I do in my book. Okay, you say that, Sheriff Clark, like Rudy Giuliani said, the overwhelming majority of people who died at the hands of each other and not police. Let's apply that to terror. How many people have died from terror in America in the last 10 years? Has it been 100 even? So why are we so obsessed with terror and terrorism and stopping the spread of terror when most white people who die at the hands of their fellow white brother or sister? It's the same logic. Stop ginning up outrage against Muhammad and the so-called scourge of the coming Islamic terror being unleashed in America and focus instead on the Billy Bob reality of white domestic intranquility. Now, that kind of logic would be insulting to many white brothers and sisters, and yet they routinely and without introspection deploy it when it comes to issues of race in America. They're both important. These issues need to be addressed, but there's a big difference. The black person in the street doesn't carry the weight and authority of the state when he or she does what he or she does. And usually when they are found, they will go to jail. But a white policeman, or a black one for that matter, who does what he or she routinely does in regard to black and brown bodies, rarely is held to account. Even the killer of Walter Scott, on video, shooting this man in his back 8 times, ended in a hung jury. That is his case. So the reality is that policemen are held to a different standard, exempt from the same kind of consideration that the average citizen would be. And the badge and the gun and a baton and a taser mean that you have the imprimatur of the state and the support of the American government to do what you do. And therefore, you should be held to a far higher standard.
Our time is moving fast, Michael Eric Dyson. We could go on here. You have the voice of a preacher in this book, the mind of a scholar, the prose of a poet. You prod us, you challenge us, you make us uncomfortable at times. How do we heal a nation that is so divided racially? What do we do with all this awareness that you're bringing to fore in this book?
Well, let's process it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it in synagogues and churches and schoolrooms. Let's talk about it on the playground. Let's speak about it at work. Remember, the former Attorney General Eric Holder said, we're a nation of cowards because we don't even speak about these issues. We rarely get together with each other beyond the workplace. And we got to find ways to facilitate interactions across a number of axes of race and gender and class and sexual orientation, and then just be human to each other and understand that, yes, we are in the same boat, and we have to tell the truth about what that means. But everybody doesn't suffer the same. Even if we're in the same boat, it doesn't mean that we're in the same position. And I think the false equivalencies that have been struck by many people in this country trying to say, hey, I'm an outraged white guy, and I'm just as upset because my jobs are not paying as well as yours, and therefore I'm subject to the same thing. Really not true. There's no false equivalence there. I mean, there's a false equivalence between the experiences of definitely besieged white workers versus those who are African-American and Latino, but there's a whole history of outrage and horror that those people have to deal with.
Last 30 seconds here. You say if things don't change, our country won't survive. And I just want you to tell us what you mean by that in our last few seconds here.
Well, if we don't face up to what we're doing, we're going downhill. We will continue to be trumped. We will continue to be victims of bigotry and blindness on all sides. What we have to do is to open up, tell the truth, be honest, and love each other into a different future.
Michael Eric Dyson, Georgetown University professor of sociology. His new book is Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. I appreciate your honesty and your time today. Michael Dyson, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the confirmation hearings for Trump's controversial Secretary of Education nominee, Betsy DeVos, will unpack the tough questions for the school vouchers advocate. Until then, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.